Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York, partnering with Grow NYC to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets. For more information, visit christmastreesny.org. Hey everyone, this is David Tatasciore, lead engineer and studio manager of the Heritage Radio Network, and I'm reaching out to ask for your support during our end of year fund drive. A contribution in any amount supports our weekly programming and our mission to make the world a more equitable, sustainable, and delicious place. Plus, you'll receive exclusive member benefits like monthly playlists, discounted event tickets, party invitations, and more. So, if you like good food and you love good food radio, throw a little dough our way. Make your gift at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Happy holidays from all of us here at Heritage Radio Network.
And welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. And in case you haven't noticed, the days are getting shorter, and of course the nights are getting longer. In fact, the winter solstice is just about upon us. It's December 21st, so whenever you are listening to this, it may have already passed, but it is indeed the shortest day of the year. Or some who are night owls would love to say, yeah, it's the longest night of the year. Well, the winter solstice has, since ancient times, has been celebrated all over the world. They've recognized this astronomical occurrence and celebrated the subsequent return of the sun. And it has a lot of connections to a lot of holidays that we now celebrate through religious, more traditional religious rites, such as Christmas and Hanukkah. And these old traditions indeed have influenced how we celebrate, along with the food and the lights and the feasting. And joining me today to talk about winter solstice celebrations, old and new, is Kathy Kaufman. Kathy is a lawyer turned professional chef and food historian with a passion for sharing knowledge of historic and contemporary foodways. She's a consultant to various museums and institutions on historic dining and is the current president of the Culinary Historians of New York and an adjunct professor of food studies at the New School. She was senior editor of Oxford University Press's Savoring Gotham and Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink. And Kathy is the author of Cooking in Ancient Civilization. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you so much, Linda. My pleasure.
You know, it's interesting. Last year this time, you and Michael Crandall were on talking about traditional and some older Christmas sweets.
Yes.
And it seems that Christmas time, and then I thought to have you on again at Christmas time, and then why do I keep thinking of Kathy at Christmas time? Well, then I recalled that one of the very first programs enlisted you to present for the culinary historians was on on Saturnalia and winter solstice celebration way back when. So I guess that's sort of ingrained in my head that Kathy can talk about winter solstice.
Well, winter solstice celebrations, Saturnalia, the Mithradic celebrations that are also part of the Roman world, they're all fascinating. And when you look at the way they are put together and some of the religious overpinnings that are placed with them, you can see an awful lot of cross-fertilization. And, you know, to try and tease out what are the original celebrations, it's kind of a fool's errand, I think. But there is a tremendous amount of literary evidence, archaeological evidence, If you are a and I'm not going to be able to pronounce this, numismatic, if you like ancient coins, you can actually also see some evidence for some of these ancient celebrations that are festivals of light or festivals honoring the return of the unconquered sun, as they like to call it.
Right. And interesting that, you know, sun appears as the festival and the celebration of the birth of rebirth of the sun, and we have in the Christian religion the birth of the sun all falling on the same day. Well, December 25th is when you actually start to notice the day getting a little bit longer, a couple days after the solstice.
It's either that, or it actually can also go back to calculations under the Julian calendar put in right. by Julius Caesar, such that December 25th was actually the day of the solstice. But I've always been amazed that people can actually detect days getting a little bit longer. I mean, think about something like Stonehenge and the way that is oriented to get the sun shining through, you know, one opening onto another spot on the solstice, how ancient people both moved those huge rocks and were able to do those sorts of calculations.
It's amazing.
And you see the same things with, you know, Druids, Celts in Brittany and Normandy. I guess when you don't have other distractions, when you're not checking your Twitter feed, you can probably be a little more observant about the length of the
day.
We
had time for so many things. Yes,
we did in those days.
Yes. Well, let's take our listeners back to whatever period you want to go to, whatever part of the world you want to focus on, because literally every part of the world was, you know, this occurred, and people in all these different areas had some type of recognition or celebration. Take us back to some of those early times.
I like to really start with Rome because we've got really good documentation, and I know a fair amount about ancient Roman food and Roman culinary culture. So there are two different celebrations we should be thinking about with Rome. The first is Saturnalia, which is the pagan celebration. It is designed to be this kind of period of social inversion where slaves and those who were economically dependent upon their socioeconomic betters had a week-long period of celebration, of being fed wonderful things. There is a line from one of the Roman authors about, "You will enjoy this pig, which was fed on acorns for your Saturnalian feast." And I think that's, you know, one of the first foundational myths of that roast boar that you think of with much more recent Christmas feasts. But you had this period where people were allowed to drink to excess. It was encouraged. It was kind of like what we see as New Year's Eve, with people getting, you know, pleasantly sloshed and then waking up with that headache on New Year's Day and eating Hop and John, because that's a, you know, good kind of
hangover
greasy
cure.
It's a good hangover cure, exactly. But Saturnalia was one of those periods where gifts were exchanged. The socioeconomic betters would make payments to those folks who were dependent on them. It was really a redistributive economic moment. Not that it lasted past the week, but it was a sort of thing that you would get essentially a Christmas tip. And that was one way of helping to ensure a social harmony among the different classes. And it was based on feasting. The other celebration in the ancient Roman world was the Mithridatic cult, which came in a little bit later. And that was one that had at its forefront the Sol Invictus, the celebration of the unconquered sun. And that was traced actually to December 25th. It was a feast that, while it was a pagan god, the Sol Invictus, it was a superior god to all others. And it actually doesn't come in until relatively late in Roman history. It's a second century AD invention or importation, and it comes from Persia, or at least it's thought to come from Persia. And there was a lot of feasting that was going with that, and it was a little upsetting to the polytheists, because this was really putting one god above Jupiter, who, you know, was up until that point the chief god in the Roman pantheon. And the feasts that were there for the unconquered sun also involved certain culinary symbols that started to look deceptively Christian. Bread was put on an altar for the unconquered sun. So very, very interesting. There, some scholarship thinks that our Christmas celebration is much more closely related to the unconquered sun of the Mithridatic cult than to Saturnalia.
That's interesting, and it does, it makes a lot of sense that coming later as it does, I mean, they were starting to have a lot of these celebrations, as you say, with different pagan gods. And the sun being one, that it was still, even though through different religions, even when through Christianity, there were still sun worshippers. They still worship, whether they called it the sun god or not. They did worship the sun god in certain ways, without it interfering with their
their Christian beliefs. Yeah. No, absolutely. If you think about the first couple of centuries after the birth of Christ, there is a tremendous amount of religious debate, shall we say, that's going on. There are all sorts of different sects, different religions. Of course, Christianity starts as kind of a heretical sect of Judaism, and we still see a little bit of that in some of the Jews for Jesus. Is that is that a Christianity? Is that a form of Judaism?
Right.
There are people who will argue both sides on that one. But it really kind of fascinating. One thing I came across, a description of a Saturnalian feast that struck me as really curious, and it hadn't hit me until very recently. One of the foods that served are fritters and cheeses for Saturnalia.
That's very interesting, because cheeses came into celebration heavily in more of the Nordic cultures as well, for their Yuletide, their Yule festivals.
Well, certainly it comes in because it's easy to preserve cheese in a northern climate.
Right.
But something that I learned recently researching Hanukkah and its origins is that cheese was considered a Hanukkah food starting around the 14th century with some of the rabbinical writings. And it's this very interesting confusion of biblical stories when original texts were lost and people had kind of debased texts. We all know the story of Hanukkah, which is a celebration of light. The Maccabees are there, defending against people who were trying to Hellenize Judea. And, there's only one day's worth of oil left in the temple, yet the temple light lamps burn for eight days. So, yes, we have to have foods cooked in oil. And, fritters are, latkes, whatever you want to call them, are one of the traditional foods. But interestingly, some of the rabbis started thinking the story of Judith and Holofernes was also a Hanukkah story, in that here is a woman who is defending Judaism against an oppressor. And what does she do? She feeds Holofernes a salty cheese that requires him to drink a lot of wine. He gets drunk and she offs him. So these rabbinical scholars are saying we should be eating cheese in addition to oil-cooked foods at Hanukkah. And then you read these Roman traditions, cheese and fritters are part of your Saturnalia feast. So it just shows the amazing overlap between what is happening in the Mediterranean region.
Right. Well, you mentioned the dates, and of course the Julian calendar, which didn't come about until later. And then I came across somewhere that in Egypt, so we're still talking here in the southern, hemisphere, that in Egypt, January 6th was noticed as the shortest day of the year. And that was celebrated as the solstice. Whereas, of course, we know it today as the Epiphany.
Yeah.
Well, and then it was also celebrated as the Epiphany of the Sun's rebirth. And the whole thing was just, you know, all tied together very nicely.
It is one of these situations where calendars have shifted. There are a bunch of days, depending upon which calendar you are looking at, are either included or excluded. So the January 6th of that Egyptian calendar and some of the Eastern Orthodox calendars actually might have fallen truly on the solstice. Yeah. It's one of those situations that we didn't have a good calendar reform going on. There wasn't a uniform calendar at
sometimes
that point.
Sometimes the sundial didn't work, too, because the sun wasn't shining. You know, so.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's another one of those great mysteries. What do you do on a cloudy day? You know, how do you go and make your calculations if you've got cloud cover?
Well, of course, all of this ties to food, gardening, harvesting, mm-hmm. and no wonder that, you know, feasts they were presented. There was a shift in, of course, the cycle of gardening and the slaughtering of animals. That's all what you, as I say, you've been talking about, you know, the Mediterranean region, mm-hmm. and there were other supplies on hand mm-hmm. where they knew they would have food even during the, you know, those heavier, darker days to come. But then you go up north to the Nordic region, and they really were concerned about having enough food to get through those dark, wintry days.
Oh, yeah. It was a much bleaker prospect. Not only are those days even shorter as you go farther north. I mean, you just think about being in northern Germany or England or Scandinavia, where you know, the sun is setting at 3:30 instead of the 5 o'clock mm-hmm. that it sets in New York. During the shortest days of the year, and you've got a shorter growing season. You've got a problem of overwintering your animals because you're not going to have access to the pasturage that you need. So there is, you know, the great slaughter that takes place, you know, starting around Michaelmas, which is in November, and you have these slaughterings and putting up meats for the winter season, sausages, hams, that sort of thing. But it takes a while for those to cure. So the Christmas holiday or any of the Yule holidays were all these feasts to eat a lot of fresh meat and put by what you could, preserve what you could, obviously, with cheeses, things like that. Drying fruits, apples, or storing them in kind of root cellar-like things, but you are absolutely correct. By February, people knew that the larder was going to be running kind of low, and this was a real period of celebration.
Right. Well, we're going to talk some more about the types of foods that we might find on some of those tables and the transition to more of our modern-day celebrations when we come back after this short break.
Ever wonder where your Christmas tree came from? Now you don't have to. New York State grown Christmas trees are now available in New York City. Trees grown on farms here in New York State are harvested just a few days before arrival to the city. Trees cut close to home stay fresh longer, and trees cut close to home travel less, which reduces fuel consumption of delivery vehicles. Did you know that buying a real tree helps to sustain agriculture in New York State by supporting local farmers and keeping important open space in agriculture production? The Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York is partnering with Grow NYC to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets in Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan. So when you shop local this holiday season, you can include the tree in that list. For more information and a full list of locations, visit ChristmasTreesNY.org.
Hi, we're back, and I'm talking with Kathy Kaufman, and we're talking about winter solstice celebrations. We've been focusing on the ancient, and Kathy, we were mentioning the slaughter and the foods, and
hard to put our finger on really what in particular would have been on a lot of the tables, but certainly our proclivity for big holiday roasts, mm-hmm. Christmas roasts, or, you know, the standing rib or the pork roast or the Christmas ham, it just seems to reason that it has its roots in a lot of these celebrations.
Oh, absolutely. When you think about the hunt, you don't want to hunt too much in the spring when animals are calving and nursing their young. You want to wait until you can be very ecologically sustainable and hunt mature animals in the fall. And, of course, you start hunting them in the fall, the wild boar, venison, other things. And these, you know, fabulously tasting animals make a very, very logical addition to your holiday feast. And, of course, there is the slaughter of animals to the extent that you are a pastoralist or a farmer that you cannot overwinter. So there are plenty of things. And I think wild boar in particular had an appeal because it's, you know, a handsome animal. The same thing with stags and venison, these very noble, aristocratic-looking animals, things that would show the proclivities of the hunter, the skill of the hunter in bringing down one of these magnificent beasts and then sharing it with community. I think that is one of the things that underlies, obviously, so many of these feasts, is that they are designed to bring communities together and to share the bounty that the successful have had with those who have not been as successful.
All right. And, of course, you were talking about the competition with the sun god during this time with in some of the ancient cultures. And up north, there was a little competition from the god Odin.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it was really, as you mentioned, it was all about the hunt. It was really about, you know, getting those animals and the sacrificing to this god, you know, the god of hunt. So it was, it's so many, so multifaceted as far as the,
well, you know,
the celebrations and the who they were, you know, honoring.
You know, it's looking at mythology, folklore. There is almost this kind of human consciousness that permeates. If you look at studies of mythology, things like, you know, Frasier's The Golden Bough, which tells you how so many different cultures have had these sorts of foundational myths and need to celebrate in certain ways. I think it's very much part of our human psyche.
All right.
That we need to do these sorts of things. One thing I was thinking about in terms of more northern climes is wassailing.
Mm-hmm.
And that has so many different manifestations. You've got wassailing in terms of going around and caroling and singing and hoping to get a little bit of a Christmas gift or tip from those that you are wassailing to. Or it's passing the big cup around with the ale and often bread in it to thicken it and often apple and some spices. But I think to me the most interesting aspect of wassailing is the stories of going into the orchards and pouring ale on the roots of the apple trees to ensure a good apple crop the following year. And, you know, that sort of wassailing, paying homage to the apple trees, to me, it tells you so much about what's happening at holidays, of being grateful for the past and also showing concern about the future, and particularly in the North, not knowing what your future was going to be.
Right. It's interesting. Several years ago, and I can't remember who was on, doing a show on a lot of these similar rites, mm-hmm. you know, like pouring, like the wassailing in the orchards, and also different foods eaten at the end of the year to bring good fortune to crops and mm-hmm. different things, like eating 9 grapes at, you know, right before the stroke of midnight or whatever mm-hmm. that, you know, I'll have to go back. That would think that was a Germanic thing. I'll have to go back and look at where
yeah,
that
I'm
was.
Yeah, I'm not sure about
but it. But you're right. There, people were very sensitive to, you know, not just feasting and drinking themselves, mm-hmm. but knowing. Well, and that's the other thing about looking forward to the new to the sun coming out again, the reveal, the rebirth, and that their crops would be growing once again. It was time to plant soon. They had to think about, you know, new crops, so that there was a lot of thought about their ongoing life.
There is that, and we don't know how far back wassailing goes, or wassailing in terms of lubricating the roots of the apple trees. It's thought to be back in Anglo-Saxon times, so going back many, many hundreds of years, although the first documentary evidence that I'm aware of is a little bit later, and I am wondering if some of this might be an effect of that mini ice age that we had in the, 15th and 16th centuries. If you look at some of those Bruegel paintings of everything being frozen over. And that is kind of the same time where you see lots of these references to wassailing. Now, it could be just mere historical accident and coincidence, because documentation, the farther back you go, the less you often tend to have. But I'm wondering if there's something, some connection between realizing that people were living in this particularly harsh micro ice age, and the need to make these offerings of whatever nature, be it, even if you are in a Catholic or Christian environment, you still, hedge your bets by watering those apple trees with your wassail.
Right. Well, of course, then there are some of us who just know that that's from whence we get our punch bowls.
Well, exactly.
and then we go on to our modern day celebrations.
Exactly.
With the punches. And and maybe still, once again, we have to think about unsure climate and what's happening. Interesting, too, that so many people, it seems that so many groups, maybe because they've abandoned their traditional religion, or any kind of forms of Christian type of celebration, there are a lot of groups going back to these winter solstice celebrations or adding them to their list. Another opportunity to celebrate, I guess.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Why not?
But modern day, it's interesting, modern day tables now with our Christmas feasts, Hanukkah celebrations, include a lot of foods of the harvest. A lot of, it's what's in season, too.
Yeah. It is what's in season. And you also think about some of the modern tables or things that are, quote, traditional. Let's talk about the Yule log.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really fun, beautiful culinary creation. Those, sponge cakes that have been rolled, they've been stuffed with either preserves or creams or a buttercream, something like that, covered with a frosting, made to look like a log. So yes, it's usually a mocha or a chocolate, something like that. And then those little meringue mushrooms and other things that go on them. Well, that Yule log, let's face it, Yule, the god Joel, that's a pagan god from the north, and all of the mythology and folklore around the Yule log of putting it on the fire earlier than Christmas Eve, and you need to allow it to burn very carefully so it does not exhaust itself during the 12 days of Christmas, and that, I guess, means you've got to jiggle it around and put other logs on, but do things because you need to keep that little tiny piece of burned ember and stick it away and then put it in the fire on the next Christmas Eve with your new Yule log, and it acts as a talisman to protect you during the year. You keep that in the house, and it's supposed to ward off fire, or if there's a horrible raging storm, you're allowed to then take it out and burn it, and that's supposed to quell the storm. But it's all of these ideas that your behavior during the Christmas season is going to determine your luck and your fate for the following year. I mean, there's so much with New Year's Eve about the first footers and how you step out of your house? Is it the right foot, the left foot, or a guest coming in? Left foot, right foot. We know the left foot from the Latin sinistra, sinister. You can't have that left foot coming in. You need dexter, that right foot coming in. The dexterous, the appropriate, the skillful. It's just, to me, fascinating the way we have been able to take these different concepts, even going back to linguistics, language, and apply them to how we look at our lives going forward in these holiday times.
I mean, you can say you're not a superstitious person, and yet your life has incorporated, one's life has incorporated all of these heretofore superstitions into our language, into common life.
Absolutely.
You don't even think about.
No, you don't think about them, and you're fooling yourself if you think you're not a superstitious person. Right. On some way, there are these just tropes that inform our life, and you'd have to grow up in a bubble not to have them impact you in very, very subtle, and that's not a bad thing. I think it is what makes us culturally interesting.
So this year, what do you anticipate is going to be on your winter solstice celebration table?
I came across online a recipe for the dark Sienese kind of spice and pepper cake. And I've clipped it. I have purchased the ingredients, and that is what I am going to be making. Well, this one is actually even pane papato. It is even fruitier than the pan forte. So I'm going to give my going to try that one, and I may be persuaded by some friends to make my traditional 12th night cake that I make every year with marzipan.
I wanted you to mention that because you made that for your first talk that I had heard on the winter solstice.
Absolutely.
And it was indeed. Talk to us a little bit about the 12th night cake.
Oh, 12th night cake is a lot of fun. Now, 12th night, of course, refers to the 12 days of Christmas. The 12 days of Christmas go back to the 6th century, actually, in the Council of Tours, when it was ruled that there would be a holiday feasting period for 12 days, starting from December 25th and going through Epiphany. That's the time it took for the wise men, the magi, to see the Christ child after seeing the star in the sky and traveling, all of that. So we understand why there are 12 days there. That's the end of the feasting season traditionally. And you would have to end that season with a final large feast. And the culmination of that feast would be a 12th night cake.
You had to have a blowout, right? Some
absolutely.
Big, some big blowout.
Absolutely. And depending upon exactly where you were and in what time of history, they were actually extremely popular in 18th and 19th century England. Beautifully decorated, they would have figures on the top that were made of marzipan and other sugar work. There would be buried in the cakes often little tokens, and whomever received the particular token, and there was meaning ascribed to whichever token was found by the diner, you might have to host the 12th night party next year. So it wasn't necessarily...
slice your cake carefully.
It was not economically always a good thing. And, it's interesting looking at these traditions, because we also see these king's cakes.
Yes.
If you are doing the New Orleans or the French version, it's the king's cake with a little bit plastic baby Jesus that gets baked into them. So you want to be careful biting down into your cake. But the 12th night cake that I make is an English version. It comes from a cookery notebook that was owned by Martha Washington. But what we know about the recipe is that it's not an 18th century American recipe. From the way it's written, it clearly goes back to England in the 17th century and truly was an heirloom. These cakes were large. She and George were thought to have been married on January 6th on Epiphany or 12th night. So there's some thought that perhaps this was her wedding cake recipe, but we don't actually know for sure. But it's a lovely cake. It's got marsala, some cognac, dried fruits, candied fruits. The nicest addition to my palate is the candied ginger that goes into it, which has such a lovely peppery flavor to it.
No. Well, whatever you find on your holiday table this season, think about it a little bit. You know, that Christmas ham, maybe the standing rib roast that you have, or just some nice nutty cookies or a fruitcake. The fruitcake, the nutty fruit with nuts and dried fruits. And you'll realize that you're eating a little bit of history.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
And I wish all of you a wonderful holiday season, and I will see you after the new year. Thanks for listening, and thank you, Kathy Coffin, for joining me.
My pleasure.
Always, always a treat to hear your great information.
Thank you.
And as you are thinking of your holiday list in the end of the year, I hope that you will add Heritage Radio Network to your list. Go to our website at heritageradionetwork.org and click on the Beating Heart. We are a member-supported radio. We need your help to keep going. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.